Well, let's start with exactly how did this mediation effort come about?
Okay, Tom. Well, the suit was originally filed in the Court of Chancery more than 2.5 years ago. And then in the first ruling in the case in November of 2018, Vice Chancellor Travis Laster rejected a bid by the state and the county defendants to have the suit dismissed. And Laster made clear then that he was not impressed with the defense arguments. They relied largely on legal technicalities rather than challenging the claims that the plaintiffs had made about school funding and below average academic performance by children with special educational needs. After that ruling, the state requested mediation, but the plaintiffs would not go along. They wanted to do discovery first, and that's a standard procedure, gathering more evidence, taking depositions from likely witnesses, and so on. After that discovery was complete, the COVID-19 pandemic hit, Delaware went into a state of emergency, and then the plaintiffs requested mediation, primarily as a show of good faith, but also as a way to possibly get this matter resolved and rolling forward without the burden of a trial at a very stressful time in our state's history.
Having said that, how likely is mediation to bear fruit in the form of a resolution to this case?
Well, personally, I don't see it happening. There are just too many areas of disagreement between the two sides. However, in an environment where we're thinking pandemic first, there are some reasons for pushing forward with mediation. It's faster. It would eliminate the possibility of time-consuming appeals. And now if I would put myself in the state's position for a moment, mediation could be done in private. And the claims that the plaintiffs had made about educational inequities, the performance gaps between low-income and middle-class students, the least experienced and lowest-paid teachers being more likely to be working in schools where children have the greatest needs. These are the kinds of things, you know, the dirty laundry of our education system, so to speak, that the state might want to avoid trying to defend in open court.
So based on what we know from filings and these depositions, can you give us a sense of where the two sides may agree and where they are really at odds? Essentially, what is this case likely to revolve around if it does go forward?
Well, okay. It's fair to say that the state and the plaintiffs do agree on the essentials, the basics in this case. Both sides agree that schools and teachers should have the resources that they need to educate children. And they do agree that that much more is needed in the way of resources to educate all our children well. However, it's when you get into the details, the specifics, that you have the disagreement. Broadly speaking, those disagreements come down to what these additional resources are that are needed and how much it might cost and who is going to wind up paying for it. And yeah, I can express those issues rather simply, but the fact is that trying to solve them is quite complex.
And having said that, you know, how is the state kind of defending itself in terms of what it's being asked by the plaintiffs?
Well, for a good number of the claims that the plaintiffs made in their complaint, the state has responded in several ways, with outright denial to specific claims, with assertions that it does not have in legalese the information or belief to know whether the claims that are being made are true, or they've tried to refute specific claims by providing examples of what they have done to address these particular issues. In addition to that, the state has provided several claims that courts call affirmative defense, and that this essentially means that they're saying, even if the plaintiff's claims are true, we can't be held responsible for them. For example, they say that state courts don't have the authority to require a tax increase because that's the responsibility of the executive and legislative branches of government. They make several arguments, so to speak, along these lines, essentially saying that even if this stuff is true, it's not our fault or we can't be held responsible.
Your piece also gives kind of a sense of what is frustrating the plaintiffs in this case is, one point, at least, is how vigorously the state is defending itself financially, correct?
Yes. This is certainly something that anyone who follows litigation involving state and local governments in Delaware is familiar with. So this often occurs in major cases. The state isn't relying on its own Department of Justice for defense. The first thing it did was it hired a major Wilmington law firm, Young, Conaway, Stargett, and Taylor, as its defense counsel. And then early this year, it reached out to Evershed Sutherland, which is a law firm in Atlanta, Georgia, and they hired one of its partners, a lawyer who has successfully defended the states of Florida and Georgia in school funding cases. And so far, the state of Delaware has paid that law firm in Georgia more than $500,000 for legal expenses. Now, it's understandable that the state would want to give itself the best possible defense whenever it's being sued, but it would be naive to read into this that hiring a lawyer with a national reputation, especially when the Delaware bar itself is so highly regarded, is an indication that the state is eager to resolve this case without going to trial.
The other thing that seems to be frustrating the plaintiffs in this case is history. And you and I have talked about this a number of times, but is it fair to say the plaintiffs believe the only way to get action is going to be through the courts based on what we've seen historically when they don't use the courts?
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. And, you know, and again, this goes back at least, 70 years, back in 1950 when public schools were still segregated. It took court action for black children to be admitted to what had then been all-white schools. And that, of course, became part of the Brown versus Board of Education decision that went to the U.S. Supreme Court. Then in the 1970s, it took a federal court order to desegregate schools in northern Newcastle County. And after that court order was lifted in 1994, the public schools pretty much resegregated, largely because of the charter school choice and neighborhood school laws that were passed between 1996 and 2000. Since then, there have been about a half dozen reports on educational equity in the state, most of them focused on the Wilmington area. But little action has been taken to address the issues that were raised in these reports. Also, in 2006, a public-private partnership wrote a report that was called Vision 2015 that called on the state to establish a simple and equitable funding system. 15 years later, still nothing has happened.
So let's get down to brass tacks here. If mediation fails, is there anything else that's likely to stave off a day in court over this?
I would say I don't think so. The trial is scheduled to start the day after Election Day, a little bit more than 9 weeks from now. Given the complexity of the issues in the case, if mediation doesn't bring movement toward a resolution, it's hard to imagine that any other sort of intervention could result in enough progress to merit not starting the trial. Now, of course, this is 2020. We don't know what's going to happen next with COVID-19 or with tropical storms for that matter. And so it might be wise to say that we should expect the unexpected.
And finally, can you quickly update us on the other half of this lawsuit? This lawsuit we're talking about today is kind of the second half of a two-pronged lawsuit focusing on the state's actual funding system. Can you tell us a little bit about the part that involved property tax collection by the counties that was ruled on earlier this year? Where does that stand?
Okay. Well, back in May, as you indicated, Vice Chancellor Laster issued a very lengthy opinion, and he stated that the current system that the counties use as the basis for setting tax rates violates the state constitution, because the last time that the counties did a property reassessment was so long ago, back in the 1970s and 1980s, that the numbers are no longer reliable. Now, May, of course, was early in our pandemic state of emergency. The county governments, who are the defendants in this part of the case, found themselves in a tough spot. They realize and acknowledge this in their request that the reassessments are the likely remedy in the case, but they worry about the pandemic's economic consequences, rising unemployment, a possible recession, and they worry that these things may make property owners unable to pay their taxes, which are due at the end of September. So they went to the court and they asked, and the court agreed to put the case on hold until the end of October. By then, the county should have a better idea of where they stand on tax collections, again, because that they're due by the end of September, and therefore they're going to be better equipped to argue their side of the case as it goes forward, whenever that picks up towards the end of the year.